We are now officially on record. I want to welcome everyone. If you haven't been here before, pleasure to have you with us. If you have been here before, I welcome you back. As you know, this is intended to be a collaborative effort, so please feel free to participate at any time along the way. Let me just place us in context to kind of review and recap a little of what we talked about last session, and then we can move forward. To better understand Rashi, we used Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, as a kind of foil. Rashbam has an almost fanatical devotion to Pshat, whereas Rashi's devotion to Pshat is more, let's say, ambivalent, in the sense that Rashi is not only interested in Pshat, but maybe half the time offers us Midrashic explanations. And we explain that Rashi has a dual agenda, whereas Rashbam is really only interested in making the text make sense. Rashi has a dual agenda. He wants to make the text make sense, but he also wants to teach, edify, moralize, and sometimes he'll give us multiple explanations, and sometimes, almost consciously or totally overtly, he'll tell us, look, in principle, this is not the most compelling explanation, but I want to tell it to you because you can learn something. You can learn something from it. Now, what I'd like to do tonight, and we'll see if we make it all the way through. If not, we'll press into next session. Is understand if perhaps there's even a third level or a third dimension to, for lack of a better term, what we could call Rashi's agenda. The first two, again, just to recap, Rashi's interested in making the text make sense. He's interested in teaching us morals and ethics and Torah values. Is there perhaps a third level to Rashi's agenda? Now, in order to get to that third level, I want to look at another level of Rashbam's commentary. Okay, so without giving too much away up front, let's jump in and we'll see how things pan out. Have a look at source number one. This is a famous pasuk in the Torah. The Torah tells us the mitzvah ki yikarei kan sipor lefanecha baderach. B'chol eitz ohal haaretz efrachim obetzim. If you happen to chance upon a bird on the road, in a tree, or on the ground, if you happen to find chicks or eggs, v'ha'im rovetzes al ha'efrachim, the mother is kind of hovering around the chicks, so al ha'beitzim, or the eggs, lo tikach ha'im al ha'banim. Okay? So you're not allowed to take the mother with the chicks or the mother with the eggs. You have to shoo away the mother bird before taking the chicks or the eggs. We're just walking in. We just started a moment ago. There's some source sheets on the table and plenty of seats here, both to my right and to my left. Okay. So what's the rationale behind this mitzvah? Any thoughts about that before we jump in?
You save the young ones.
You save the young ones. Well, you're going to take, meaning you're just shooing away the mother bird, and then you're going to go have dinner. You're going to take the eggs and make dinner. So you're not saving necessarily the young ones. Pity on the mother. Somehow it's more compassionate if you take the eggs when the mother's not around. You send away the mother. Okay, so that's great. Have a look at source number two. Here's what the Rashbam says on this pasuk. It says lo sikacha emal habani. So he says something very interesting. Lefi derach eretz, according to, let's say, without translating that too carefully, lefi derach eretz, that according to the way of the world, ulechuvas haminin, and now this is a phrase I want to come back to, and as a rebuttal against, how would you translate minin?
Heretics,
right? So it definitely could mean heretics. Mr. Kaufman is correct. It definitely could mean, meaning Jews by birth who have, rebelled against Judaism, either converted out or have begun to adopt a heretical viewpoint, or outright Christians, right? It could be a kind of euphemism. He doesn't want to say necessarily Christians because maybe it would get censored, what have you. It says, L'chuvas, meaning, let's just leave it at heretics for the sake of simplicity. I say it's just a source sheet on the way in. As an answer to the heretics, Kvar pirashti belosav hashal gziba chalev imo. V'chein v'oso v'espino. Shedome lachzarios v'ravanus lakachas lishchot uvashel v'lechol eim uvanim yachas. The Rashbam says, you know, there are actually three mitzvot that I want to group together in one category. And he says, I've explained this actually at other points along the way. He says, one is the one that's in front of us. Don't take the mother with the chicks. A second is Lo Shevashel Gediba Chalev Imo. It's the source that tells us, don't have milk and meat together. Lo Shevashel Gediba Chalev Imo. Now, again, remember, parenthetically, that Rashbam is most interested in pshat. Okay, and again, without getting too wrapped up in this explanation of the word pshat, let's just assume that means the most simple or literal interpretation. So what's Rashbam going to say? Just parenthetically, we'll come back to our source in a second. What's he going to say about the mitzvah of Lo Shevashel Gediba Chalev Imo? He's going to take it literally. Meaning, he's not going to reject the homiletic interpretation, the Talmudic interpretation, the halachic interpretation, that this is the basis for the mitzvah not to eat milk and meat, not to cook milk and meat, etc. But he's also going to tell you, you have to read the text literally, you can't ignore, meaning there's an implicit question anytime the text says something euphemistically or offers some kind of means of communication that's less than direct. So, meaning, if the Torah didn't want you to cook milk and meat, the Torah should just say explicitly, don't cook milk and meat. Why did the Torah say, Lo Shevashel Gediba Chalev Imo? Why did it say, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk? So Rashbam says, okay, there's multiple levels of interpretation. There's the midrashic or halachic interpretation, which tells you the actual law. But then there's also the literal interpretation. There's also, I don't know if you call it a halacha, but the Rashbam would tell you, according to the Torah, don't take a kid, right, and cook the kid in its mother's milk. Think, forget about kashrus, forget about, think, just a simple value that the Torah is propounding here. Don't cook a kid in its mother's milk, right? He's going to group that together with two other mitzvot. One, shiluach hakan, sending away the mother bird, and the third we'll come to in a second. Avi, question?
But it says Lo Shevashel Gediba Chalev Imo more than once.
Yeah, it says it three times.
Three times?
Yeah.
Does he have a different interpretation for each place it's said, or does he repeat his own?
Okay, so that's a great question. I actually don't remember if he interprets it differently each time. Meaning he's not going to reject, you know, he's not an antinomian in the sense that he's going to reject the exegetical principles in the Talmud which tell us why it's repeated three times, but he's going to say there's an additional, right, in addition to those three let's say halachos that are derived from the repetition, there's going to be another level, which is the literal level, which we've just neglected, the Rashbam will say. Think, stop neglecting it. There's also literal interpretation, and this is grouped together in a whole theme, right? Mitzvah number one, don't take the mother with the kids. Mitzvah number two, don't cook the kid in its mother's milk. And mitzvah number three, oso vespino, don't slaughter a mother animal and its child and its offspring on the same day, right? Okay, you can do it the next day, you can do it 2 days apart, but don't slaughter them together. You're saying, what's the rationale behind all three of those mitzvot? Right, to tell you, right, to tell you, if you look at the English translation over here, that that appears like cruelty and voraciousness to take or slaughter or cook or eat the mother and its young together. All three of these mitzvot can be explained in a totally rational, literal way. Now, you could read that interpretation and just gloss right over it, fly right by it. That's Rashbam as his normal shita to explain the text literally and to extract the pshat from the text. But he introduced the explanation with these very important words, ulitshuvas hamin. And this is a phrase that actually appears a number of times in the commentary of the Rashbam, as an answer to the heretics, as an answer to the Christians.
Maybe the Karaites,
from a historic perspective, I don't know how active they were in 11th century, 12th century France. Yeah, meaning he's a little later than the Karaites. The Karaites are still around a little bit, but they were a little bit of a fringe group even from when they got started. But 12th century France, the Christians are not a fringe group. They're in the majority by a long shot. So So what's the Rashbam doing here? Meaning, what's the alternative interpretation of this pasuk? Or to give a little hint, what's the implicit criticism of this pasuk? The implicit criticism of this pasuk on the part of Christian readers of this text is, it doesn't make any sense. It's a chok to shoo away the mother bird, let's think about it. You're going to take the chicks anyway, and then you're going to shoo away the mother. What are you doing? Why would you possibly have any interest in doing that? So the Christians say, this is the old text, which, you know, is a little outdated, a little outmoded. We've updated it with the New Testament. And, you know, obviously, we have a number of criticisms to lay against the Hebrew Scriptures. One of them is that you have a lot of laws which don't really seem to make much sense. Rashbam comes along and tries, at the very least, to create some rationale for what otherwise could be construed or misconstrued as a law or as a practice that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. Let me throw out another example, which I hope will clarify this point. Look at, so any questions up until this point? Yeah, Ellie.
Could it be considering it also to feel paranoid or that they're being accused of doing what the person tells you not to do?
I don't know if I totally understand the question. That could be
the Christians might think, you know, we don't do things like that. Why are you know, saying don't do that?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, which is, you know, it doesn't make sense to us to act that way. You know, so why would the text be telling us to do that?
The Christians were trying to look at the text as a metaphor, where they're trying to emphasize the child.
Yeah, that's a great point. We're going to come to that in a few minutes. Very often, and we're going to see this very explicitly, Christian interpreters of the text wanted to read it less literally, more metaphorically, and that could give rise to all kinds of interpretations which take us very far from, let's say, the classic Talmudic or Midrashic interpretations of the text. And Rashbam is definitely, right on some level, attempting to stave off or to preempt those kinds of readings. Let me just share with you one more example. Jesse?
Okay. I just find it fascinating that this is a puzzle that made Elizabeth really a hair.
Yeah, meaning that's a great point, which is that there are certain psukim in the Torah which have always, you know, challenged us and challenged the faith of Jewish readers. So it's not coincidental that, you know, Christians would take those, you know, ayin tachas ayin, an eye for an eye. So it's like, are you kidding? What kind of outdated religion would say that? So it's not surprising, let's say, that the Rashbam would have to, or would be motivated, or would be interested in offering us an alternative means by which to explicate the text, so that you wouldn't have to resort to something homiletical or something which could give rise to a heretical interpretation of the text. Joseph?
This has always been one of the most prevalent things that I read, where it teaches you probably more, it teaches the individual more about how to conduct themselves. It is about your compassion to the animal, but right. You know, it's an animal still.
Right.
It's teaching us.
Yeah, and that's the direction Rashbam is going, for sure. Avi?
Well, following Joseph, could that be one of the reasons that Shmuel Chacham actually states with his scholars in Halacha Yomim?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it in those terms. I don't know the answer to that question. There might be a connection there. Manny?
I'm not sure, but don't the Christians have an imagery of the bird being Jesus? And theology.
Hang on to that thought, because I don't actually know. That could be. fishes?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So hold on to that, because I'm not an expert on Christianity, but have a look. But have a look for a moment at source number 3. Okay. Source number 3 is taken from the 17th chapter of Shmos. We're jumping around because I want to try and make this argument, which will hopefully gather steam as we see a couple of these sources. 17th chapter of Shmos, the Jewish people have just been attacked by Amalek, and now Yeshua has been sent out to lead an army to fight the Amaleki army. And the Torah says in source number 3, Vayak Hasher Yarim Moshe Yado, Vigavar Yisrael, Vikasher Yaniach Yado, Vigavar Amalek. So what happened? The Torah says that whenever Moshe would hold up his hands, the Jewish people would emerge victorious. And whenever his hands were lowered, the Amaleki people, the Amaleki army, would start to win the battle. Okay? So that's just the literal right meaning of the text. Okay? Now here's what Rashbam says. So what does that mean, Vigavar Yisrael? That the Jewish people would start to win the battle whenever Moshe raised his hands. Was that a miracle? Was that, I mean, how do you explain that? Put yourself, before looking at the Rashbam's answer, put yourself in his shoes for a second. You're a literalist. You want to understand what that means. Meaning, miracles aside, why would that be that when Moshe suddenly raised his hands, the Jewish people started to win the battle? So here's what Rashbam says. I'll tell you why. Shekeng derech archei milchama. Says that's how it happens at the battle lines. Kol zman shiroim haramas nisam. As long as they can see their banner, right, like the army's flag, right. As long as they see that. So kol zman shiroim haramas nisam or konfon. Belaz, right? He gives some French word which tells you a word for banner or flag, right? Hamis Gabriel. Whenever they see it, they start to win. What's that? Ukshu mushlach ragilin lanus ulinatzeach. Right? Whenever it's raised, they prevail. When the banner is lowered, when it comes down, they generally flee and are defeated. Right? So this is a national, right? Exactly. Meaning that's the flag was still there. That gave hope. That gave inspiration to the army. So that's what the Rashbam said. Nothing fancy. It's not that Moshe somehow's hands are miraculously allowing the Jewish people to win the battle. Saying that's just if you've ever been to battle, Rashbam says that's a kind of common thing that Moshe. I don't know if he's actually holding up a banner, but he was the national icon. And whenever they would see Moshe's hands raised, they would know, right, that there was still hope, there was still inspiration, and they would start to win. Ira?
Well, it's a weak explanation because anybody who saw what was happening would immediately transfer the banner to somebody else. If Moshe's hands are getting tired, and Amaleki's winning, and the banner is so important, have some other schlep.
Okay, sure. So I think what the Rashbam is saying is maybe not literally that there was a banner, that you know Moshe's holding up of his hands could be thought of the way that we think of an army with a banner, with a flag.
Then it's Moshe that's spoken about.
Right. Meaning it's Moshe's hands. Moshe's hands are the national symbol of victory, of pride. So when the Jewish people see those hands up, they know that things are going to go well. That inspires them. They start to win.
Yeah,
Aaron and Hur, right? Two men at his sides holding up, because his hands got tired, the Torah says, so they held up his hands. But yeah, so that is a famous medrash, and that's what Rashbam is really responding to. Yes, tell me your name.
Apparently, it had tremendous symbolic significance then that we would not have today.
That's possible. That's possible. Meaning, you're saying there might be something here that we didn't totally get that might have been going on. That might have been going on then, Lenny. Tactical. Go ahead. Okay. So you're saying a slightly
flank. You think it is simply militaristic maneuver with directions from Moshe, right?
Right.
Point. Any number of things.
Right. So essentially what you're meaning, you're accepting, right, you're accepting the basic premise of Rashbam and offering an alternative kind of interpretation.
Looking for a reason to understand Rashbam in actuality. Because he's saying nothing that the Pasuk doesn't say.
Okay. So that's a great segue. Hang on 1 second, Alan. But meaning, so why is it? Why does Rashbam offer this interpretation? So if you have a look at source number 5, right, it helps explain what is going on. So this is a book by Brevard Childs called the Book of Exodus, a Critical Theological Commentary. And he just points out in just a one-liner, we could talk about this at length. He says, Origen, one of the early Christian readers of the Bible, Origen saw Jesus foreshadowed in the name Joshua, who was fighting this battle, Yoshua, related to the word Yeshu, etc. The raised hands, but according to Origen, the raised hands signified his cross, and the defeat of the Amalekites, the victory over evil. Now, I always have this image of Moshe going like this. Christian readers of the Bible have more of an image of something, I don't know, like that. Or like this, right? Out this way, right? Moshe, you know, the goalpost, right? It's a foreshadowing, according to the Christian readers, of Jesus on the cross. So now, to answer Lenny's question, why would the Rashbam, what is he really adding? Rashbam is saying, I can tell you how to read the pasuk without resorting to the homiletical or metaphorical explanations of the Christian readers of this text. Make sense? You buy it? Meaning the Rashbam is not telling you, he doesn't introduce this comment specifically by saying, I want to preempt the Christian interpretation of this text, so let me explain to you what the pasuk really means. He doesn't tell you that, but I think it's possible to make the argument that in point of fact, sometimes what Rashbam is doing is actually either preempting or maybe even specifically answering, right, kinds of commentaries like this one. And it's possible, and we'll talk more about this in a moment, that Rashbam himself may have even had direct personal contact with Christian theologians in 11th, 12th century France, where these kinds of polemics were in the air, and where this was part of the dialogue. Alan?
And I think it's just writing it in terms of when he was living. According to the pasuk, if we read it in the Torah, that we would think that, you know, God just saved the Jewish people and they had all these miracles. I would assume that, you know, if they have a belief in Hashem, you know, Hashem's going to save them from the Amalekites. So, I mean, it's
Rashbam is just dealing with the interpretation in terms of when he's living, not in terms of what really is transpiring. He's just maybe writing it in terms of what he wants to do for his time and people.
Right, so I think there's a very important point, which is part of Rashbam's agenda to deal with a contemporary, relevant, current need in, let's say, 11th, 12th century France of, let's say, Jewish readers of the text who could be misled by these kinds of Christian readings of the text. So he's coming, right, to give an alternative reading of the text, which would remain true to the Torah without a reader needing to resort to the Christian interpretation. That's fascinating. It's actually a Kri and a Ksiv, if I recall correctly, where it's written Yado, but it's pronounced Yadav.
Right.
Right. So we say, meaning it's written Yado, his hand, but we understand it to mean Yadav, his hand.
Right. It may be, you know, there was a point in time where there were so many different versions and we had to file, and it may have been a different Christian version.
That's an excellent point, and we're going to come to that, which is that, again, meaning the Christians were primarily dealing with Latin translations, you know, the Vulgate, Latin translations of the Septuagint, of the text. And there were some translations which themselves, right, gave rise to or sort of leaned in a particular direction or a particular interpretation. And part of what we're going to see Rashbam is doing is taking us back to the, you know, to the Hebrew text and interpreting it according to those lines, you know, of logic, of grammar, of context, etc.
forgive me if you covered this, because I'm sort of lost here. Are we looking at this through Christian eyes as well? Because in the context of 11th, 12th century France, the raising of a flag or a standard was merely for identification. It was not for the winner of the battle. Battles were choreographed and timed. So if you raised, I don't get Moses' arms as being a standard of any kind.
But meaning Reshbaum could have also, meaning Reshbaum knows that he's living, you know, 2,500 years after after the giving of the Torah. So meaning it's as if, you know, let's say Lahavdil, we're reading, you're writing a commentary on Homer in the 11th century. So, you know, you have to separate between the context in which you're living and the historical reality in which your commentary is going to exist. So he's saying at the time that you know, that the battle was being waged between Moshe, Yeshua, and Amalek, this is what could have been going on. Not that this was going on in 11th, 12th century France, but that this was perhaps the historical,
so the historical reality. The answer was like,
yeah, it was like a scene in Homer where you know, Agamemnon comes out with a big, you know, I don't know if that actually happened in the Odyssey, but I mean in the Iliad.
So, well,
yeah.
Why does I still don't understand why Reshbaum feels compelled to put in this explanation? Why couldn't he just say it was a miracle? Like, it seems like to me he's rejecting, like, what I always understood this to be. You know, it's a miracle. Moshe held this hands out, Hashem helped. Whatever reason, like, just like one of the other miracles, just like all the other miracles.
So I think that is a great, great question. And I think what Reshbaum is really doing, and we'll talk about more about this in a minute, is he's subtly critiquing that approach at interpretation, which is to say, I mean, what's the problem with that interpretation? According to Reshbaum's mind, the problem with that interpretation is, once you're taking a leap of faith, what's going to make you take the leap of faith in the direction of Judaism versus the direction of Christianity? So the Christian reader will tell you, you know, it was it's just prefiguring Jesus and the miracle of Jesus' salvation. You know, so what makes one stronger than the other? As long as you're saying, trust me.
There were miracles throughout the whole Torah. I mean,
right.
There's miracles all over. So why couldn't this just be another?
And what you'll note is a great question, and Reshbaum bends over backwards often to try and either eliminate or minimize the extent to which we're forced to kind of believe in a miraculous occurrence for exactly that reason. Because as soon as you start down that road, right, then you run the risk of, well, if you believe in if you're just saying trust me, so trust me about X, Y, or Z, I mean, what makes my explanation any more compelling than the next guy's? If you can come and produce something which really is compelling because it sticks to the pshat of the text. So now, right, we're not having a theological debate anymore. I just obviated the need for any kind of theological assumptions or interpretations. Just read the text with me, the Reshbaum is saying. Here's the literal explanation.
The Torah doesn't say it's a miracle.
Correct. Meaning, and that's why the Reshbaum has license to interpret the text in this way. Right? Meaning, I don't mean to be flippant about it. Meaning, the Reshbaum isn't telling you that the other explanation is wrong. He's not telling you, if you think it's a miracle, you're wrong. I don't think the Reshbaum is telling you that. I think the Reshbaum is telling you, I can give you another way to read the text where you don't have to go down the path that can get you into trouble. Lenny?
Can you read the Reshbaum metaphorically? What he's saying to his people is, in marvelous times, if you keep the faith, you will prevail.
That is fascinating. That's really, you know, a level a little more complicated than I want to get into, which is, you know, is there a kind of you know, double meaning in the Reshbaum's shot? You know, if there were a course in Reshbaum, I would go there. You think it's the shot in what Reshbaum's saying? That's interesting. Meaning, I think there's something there. And again, I don't mean to paint, you know, Reshbaum as so diametrically opposed to Rashi. Obviously, Reshbaum is interested also in making the text relevant and teaching, you know, lessons about. I mean, the Reshbaum is living in the Crusades, right? I mean, he's got an audience and a readership that's dealing with major crises of faith and belief and theology, right? So I don't mean to say that this is not on the Reshbaum's mind, but I think it can be argued that this is one of the priorities in the Reshbaum's on the Reshbaum's agenda.
I'm just kind of stuck up on your original point about whether we buy that, you know, those are conflicting theologians. I'm curious if you curious as to what the commissioner said about it.
Yeah.
And like here we have a sort of, obviously if it was just an issue of censorship, you wouldn't have said that in the first place. So
right.
It's just like a speech.
So that's a great question. You know, one possible explanation. Everyone hear Connie's question? Connie's question was, if it's really true, if you want to make this this argument that so much of Rashbam's commentary is really motivated by a desire or a need to answer Christian polemics, so why is he only explicit about it sometimes? Right? If that's always what he's out to do, why doesn't he always say it, or why doesn't he never say it? Right? The fact that he only says it, let's say, half a dozen times or a dozen times in the course of his explanation in the whole Torah, so doesn't that mean that that's a sidebar and not really a primary focus? So I think that is a great question. Let's just actually jump for a second to the next two sources, and then I want to return to your question. So it's actually a debate. Have a look at source number 7 for just a second on page 2. It's actually a debate among contemporary scholars whether or not this is really going on as a subtext in the Rashbam commentary. If you're really interested in answering the Christian polemics. You have a look at source number 7. So this is the introduction to really the only extant translation into English of Rashbam's commentary by a professor in Canada. I forget if he's at Toronto or Montreal, by a fellow named Martin Luxon. So he writes the following. I've actually cut and paste two different paragraphs, even though they're not written together. But you'll see why. So it's my contention that opposing Rashi's commentary is Rashbam's primary goal in his own commentary. Okay? Notwithstanding Rashbam's occasional positive comments about Rashi, which are almost always couched in generalities, rarely referring positively to any specific interpretation of Rashi, the evidence will show that the vast preponderance of Rashbam's interpretations are directed against Rashi. Okay? So the interest in intellectual honesty, and in all fairness, there is a school of thought, right, as propounded by Professor Luxon, that this is not really, right, to come back to Fani's point, this is not really the Rashbam's primary focus. It happens occasionally. Sometimes Rashbam will mention an argument which happens to respond to a Christian polemic, to a heretical reading, what have you. That's going on. He says, no, you know, Rashbam is really interested in something totally other. Rashbam is interested in opposing the views in Rashi's commentary. That's his main focus. That's his main goal. This business about Christian polemics, that's a sidebar. Okay. Continuing in source number 7 for a second, he just summarizes the original source, actually an academic Hebrew, so it's good that he summarized it for us. Another contemporary scholar in Israel named Elazar Tweedo, who is really the world expert on Rashbam, he writes the following. Tweedo's own theory relates the sudden growth and decline of Pshat exegesis to novel developments in Jewish-Christian polemics in the 12th century. He claims that Rashbam's commentary is directed precisely against Christian polemical tactics. While Rashbam declares explicitly only 3 times that a particular interpretation of is polemically motivated, Tweedo claims that the entire commentary is implicitly polemical. Okay, so he's really responding directly to Chani's point. It only comes up a few times where he mentions the polemics or mentions the heretics or the Christians explicitly, but Tweedo wants to argue that really that's the undercurrent of the entire commentary of Rashbam. Tweedo also claims that Rashbam's commentary, particularly its emphasis on Pshat, is strongly influenced by the Christian exegetical works of his times. Both Jewish and Christian contemporary commentaries are, according to Tweedo, products of the so-called 12th century Renaissance, in that they re-emphasize the literal meanings of biblical texts and attempt to confront the problem of the conflict between traditional exegesis and rational knowledge. According to Tweedo, Rashbam's commentary is to be seen somewhat paradoxically as both an emulation of and a polemic against Christian exegesis of his day. According to Tweedo, Rashbam is knee-deep in the business of Pshat explanation, just as the Christians were knee-deep in interpreting the text with their own agenda, and Rashbam was directly involved in polemics against Christians. To answer Chani's question, meaning if you're Tweedo and you buy this argument and Rashbam is really a polemic against Christians, why isn't he more explicit about it? So one possible explanation is that Rashbam's commentary is actually a combination of, verbal or oral teaching and written commentaries. So it's possible, I'm going to give two answers to your question. One possibility is that when Rashbam is explicit in mentioning an answer to heretics or to Christians, it's because he actually had that debate. He actually had that dialogue. He actually had that dispute with some Christian theologian in his neighborhood. And now he's recording it and saying, oh, and as an answer to the heretic, this is what I said. This is my explanation. Right? You can see the kind of, like a local disputation, the local rabbi, the local priest get together, this is the debate, he records the debate. As opposed to the rest of his commentaries, which incidentally, right, or implicitly are aimed at the same audience or at the same goal, but he never actually had that disputation publicly. Alternatively, almost kind of as an opposite answer to your question, it's possible that he never had those disputations with the Christians, but what he tells you, when he says l'tshuva l'minim, he's telling you you could make a preemptive strike. You know, maybe he's saying that the Christians haven't actually given any other compelling explanation, but if you give this one, then you can be sure that you would beat them in any kind of dispute, in any kind of argument, as opposed to the rest of his commentary, which is actually coming as an opposition to existing comments made by Christians in their attempt to interpret the Torah. So far, so good. To recap, two possible ways to understand what Rashbam is doing in his commentary. Lakshin would tell you, no, Rashbam is simply coming to oppose Rashi, right? Tweedo would tell you the whole of Rashbam's commentary, as I think is, you can tell which side I lean toward, the whole of Rashbam's commentary is really intended to answer contemporary Christian readers of the text who would cause Jews to go astray. I lean a little toward the Tweedo camp, which is to say that really there is a strong polemical, I don't want to say that it's all or nothing, but I think there is a strong polemical voice in Rashbam's commentary. Matt?
Is another reason that he could be writing this way is to prevent anti-Semitic acts against Jews? Yeah, I was going to say that. Christians, to incite Christians to say that.
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. From a historical perspective, I don't know if you could really make that case. I mean, again, it's hard to imagine the times they're living in. They're literally in the middle of the Crusades. Right? They had Rashi, Rashbam, they have relatives who, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashbam's own brother, right, was taken captive by these Crusaders. Right? So I don't think anyone, I don't think the Rashbam specifically, right, for sure, has any kind of illusions about, oh, well, if he could just give a good drasha on Shabbos morning, you know, he's going to stop the next pogrom. So I don't think there's, I don't think that's really kind of like a realistic...
That's not what I'm asking. What I'm saying is that Christian leaders could be using some of their theories to...
Right. So what I mean to say, yeah. So what I mean to say is, I don't think any Christian leaders really care too much about what Rashbam is saying. I think Rashbam's audience is really Jews who might be on the fence, who might be susceptible to heretical readings or to Christological readings of the text, where they could sort of be susceptible to falling into that trap. You look at back in page one, I have just for interest sake, there is a, where do we get our information about 12th century France? You know, So our sources are limited, you know, and we're forced to speculate to a large degree. But there are some, important sources. One of which is actually a fascinating autobiography. I don't know if it's ever been translated. I certainly never saw it in translation. Is a fascinating autobiography written by a man named Hermanus. I actually don't know how to pronounce his name. I think it's Hermanus. I'm in source number 6 on page 1. Hermanus. Any Latin speakers?
Hermanus.
Hermanus. Okay, so if you have a look at source number 6, this fellow Hermanus actually wrote an autobiography in the 12th century, and here's just a kind of synopsis. Hermanus, who was originally named Judah ben David HaLevi, okay, he was born a Jew, was born in Cologne at the end of the 11th century, and frequently traveled to Mainz on business. When still a young man, he lent money to a guy named Ecbert, bishop of Munster, without receiving a pledge in return. His parents then sent him, accompanied by his tutor, Baruch, to the bishop's court to collect the pledge. In the course of 20 weeks he spent at Ecbert's court, Hermanus had the opportunity to attend the bishop's sermons and to take part in the religious disputations. It seems that soon after his return home, Hermanus showed definite leanings toward Christianity. He traveled to Worms, where he preached Christian ideas to the Jewish community. He was baptized about 1128, and 5 years later became a member and eventually prior of the... Help me out. Okay, that order in Skeeda, Westphalia. Right? His autobiography, anyone? Very nice. Everyone together now. No, I'm just kidding. Which first appeared in print in the year 1687, includes a description of Jewish life in Germany. And what this doesn't tell you is that in his autobiography, he goes on to say that it was because of the Christian interpretations of the Hebrew Bible that he was, let's say, persuaded to lean toward Christianity and eventually become this abbot and high-ranking Christian theologian in Cologne. Okay, so I just use this as a kind of fun historical reference. Yeah, meaning to make the case that or to ballast or support the argument that this was a real issue. Meaning this is the presupposition for everything that I want to argue. If there were never an example of any Jew who ever converted to Christianity, right, and whoever was swayed by some kind of Christian polemic or Christianity of the Torah, so then everything is moot. Then you couldn't make this argument about the Rashbam. But because we do have this and other historical examples of where Jews were really swayed by Christian readings of the text, I think it is a plausible argument to make to say that the Rashbam was really concerned about keeping these Jews on the Jewish side of the fence and giving them an alternative, a way to read the Torah that didn't necessarily resort to a Christological interpretation of the text. Any let's say leftover questions on this argument? Mr. Gaffin.
But the same with Rashi too. Rashi was well aware of the propaganda petition. For example, it's written after he was thrown out of the Gan Eden, Adam Yada Ishto. You know, they had sex. The Christians say that they did not have sex in the Gan Eden. Rashi does not mention what the Christians say, but if you look at Rashi, he goes overboard with explanations that they had sex in the Gan Eden also.
So that is a great point, and that is a great segue, because what I want to do right now is turn to Rashi and ask you, right, the same question. You could either buy it about the Rashbam or not. I think there's a case to be made, right? The question is, when it comes to Rashi, can you make the same argument that this was really, right, a kind of third level of valence in Rashi's agenda? Not only was he interested in making the text more readable and accessible to the readership, not only was he interested in making the morals, values, and ethics of the Torah more known to his readership, but maybe, like Rashbam, right, in which case it's more obvious, but Rashi actually, right, predates Rashbam by 50 years, maybe Rashi is also, right, on this same kick, And maybe there's also a kind of undercurrent in Rashi's commentary, part of his agenda, perhaps, right, can you make the case that part of Rashi's commentary is an attempt to preempt or dispute Christian interpretations of the Torah? Avi, question?
No, I was concerned about something else. Is there any reason given why Rashbam's main goal was to oppose whatever Rashi
said? Yeah, I was going to ask that. I mean, it seems a little far-fetched.
Yeah, so that's a good question. Meaning, we could talk more about that, and if this were a course in Rashbam, I would. You know, the simple answer is that Rashbam felt Rashi had not gone far enough. Meaning, Rashi had begun to introduce Pshat in conjunction with Medrash into the interpretation of the Torah, and that's what really pervades his commentary. And Rashbam felt he didn't push the envelope, you know, far enough, and Rashi was still too reliant on Midrashic interpretation. So Rashbam felt that it was his, you know, his calling to oppose Rashi, not for the sake of opposing Rashi, but really to sort of, you know, finish the project that Rashi himself never really accomplished, which is to say, can you interpret the text exclusively in a pshat way? So, you know, there's more to it, but in a nutshell, I think that's what Lakshin here means when he tells you what, when he tells you that Rashbam's main goal was to oppose Rashi. Okay. Any other leftover thoughts?
It seems like Rashbam, I mean, sometimes he's just trying to, I mean, if you put aside the question of refuting Christians, I think he's just trying to give an explanation of what the words are. But like with the sending away the mother bird, he's giving a kind of a rational kind of philosophy to the mitzvahs, which is a little bit more than just explaining it.
Right, I think you're right, and this comes back to Lenny's point, perhaps, which is that it would be very hard to make the case that Rashbam is, you know, just a kind of grammar commentary or just a kind of, you know, straight literalist. There's always, you know, an undercurrent of, you know, let's tease out the moral value. It's much less explicit than in Rashi, but I think it's there as well. Okay, so join me, if you will, at source number 8 on toward the bottom of page 2. Okay, coming back to Mr. Kaufman's point, I don't have Mr. Kaufman's source here, but I have a variation of that same theme. Okay, in source number 8, the Torah says, "Vayomer Elokim naseh Adam b'tzalmenu." This is Bereishis Aleph, first chapter of the Torah. "Vayomer Elokim naseh Adam b'tzalmenu kidmoseinu." So, how would you translate that? God said, "Let's make man in our image, in our likeness." The obvious unstated question being,
who's
we, Kimosavi, right? Very nicely stated. We're trying to, and our friend Fruma actually last week asked this very strong question, which is, right, Elohim itself is plural, and now, if you wanted any evidence that there was a pantheon, I mean, what a great, I mean, this is chapter 1 of Genesis. You're telling me this is a religion of monotheism? I mean, Naseh Adam B'Tzalmenu, let's make man in our image. Who's talking here?
It's the royal
we.
Talking to the angels.
Talking to the angels. Okay. So now look what Rashi. Now look what Rashi does, and look what Rashi says in source number 9. Naseh Adam, let's make man. What does he say? Afal pi shelo siyuhu b'tzirasa. Even though the we, right, whoever he's talking to, doesn't actually help in the creation process. And this is the key line. It's an amazing line. The yesh makom l'minim lirdos, and it gives an opening to the heretics to promote their heresy. I mean, it's unbelievable. Rashi is explicit about it. He knows darn well, right, what the Christians or what the let's say people who oppose the Torah could be saying. He knows exactly how they're going to read this pasuk. He says, you know what? Doesn't matter. Lo nimna hakasa milolane derech eretz umidas anava. He says, and this is mind-blowing. He says, knowing that this was going to give an opening to those heretics, the Torah went out of its way to write the text in this fashion for the sole purpose of teaching you derech eretz and the trait of humility. That God, the big one, would come and ask permission from the much smaller ones, from the heavenly court, from the angels, what have you. It's an amazing philosophical, theological statement. Rashi is telling you, I know exactly what's going to happen because the Torah is written in this way, but it doesn't matter. The Torah is willing to take that chance because the Torah has a higher value, has a higher ethic, and that's, right, coming back to Rashi's second agenda, to teach you the moral and ethical lessons that the Torah wants to teach you. Continuing in source number 9 in the middle of the second line, Dimkasav es Adam, if the Torah would have said what it should have said, I'm going to make man, right, lo lamanu shehe medaberim beistino ela imatzko. I wouldn't have known anything about the heavenly court, I wouldn't have known anything about this conversation, I wouldn't have learned any moral. And now, you ready for the last line? That's Rashi's, what would you say, that's Rashi's primary comment, that's Rashi's primary interpretation. And now he says something stunning. The Truvas Haminim Kasav Bitsido V'Yivra'u Lukim Es Adam V'Lo Kasav V'Yivra'u. He says, but by the way, what are you going to tell those people? What are you going to tell those people who are going to read the text literally, are going to challenge you and say, hey, you think Elohim is one God? Why is it written in the plural? So Rashi says, I want to give you the answer to that question. I want you to know that there's a good grammatical rebuttal to that question. He said, I'll tell you what it is. Atshuvas Haminim, the answer is, it says right before, Vayivra Elohim es Adam, if you know anything about grammar, it says Vayivra, which means right in the singular, right, and he created. It never said Vayivra'u, and they created. He says, I can tell you, right, based on the consistency of the pasuk, gracious bara Elohim, right? It's in the singular. There's no Vayivra'u, there's no and they created. So Rashi is totally aware, right, of the potential for how this text could be read. And now he really ties, right, all three of the agendas, which I'd like to argue are going on here, really ties all of them together. He makes the text readable, right, because he tells you how to read the pasuk, just simply what it means. Then what he does is he does this so explicitly. He says the pasuk was willing to sacrifice, right? The pasuk was willing to open itself up to heretical interpretation for the sole purpose of teaching you a moral lesson, right? What a beautiful image of God, the King, going and asking permission from his court to produce and to create the world. Right, the second level, the second valence that Rashi is interested in telling you how the Torah is expressing its highest values and ethics. And now this third level, also totally explicit, he says, and I want to tell you how to rebuff the heretics, how to rebuff anyone who would try and read this pasuk in a way which would give strength or backing to a Christian interpretation of the text. The answer is, look at the next pasuk, look at the preceding pasuk. The consistent theme is the singular. There's an aberration which is in the plural. The aberration can be explained because the Torah is interested also not just in telling you a history, but in teaching you the valuable ethical lessons that the Torah holds so dear. Now, I want to actually stop here because the next couple sources are going to take us deeper into this rationale. We'll close with any questions, but this is the argument that I'd like to make, that there's a third valence here, and there are echoes. I mean, it's more explicit in the Rashbam, but I think the case really can be made that this is a kind of secret, sometimes implicit, rarely explicit. This is one of the rare cases where it's explicit, but there is this kind of secret, implicit, third level of Rashi's agenda to try and help readers of the Torah in the 11th century in France, right, and wherever Rashi's commentaries are being read, to try and help those readers rebuff and answer the Christian interpretations of the text. Matt?
Why would Rashi not use the Rashi interpretation of this move?
So, I mean, that's a big question. Sometimes when Rashbam doesn't comment at all, sometimes that is an indicator that he accepts Rashi's interpretation, right? He doesn't think Rashi is wrong all the time, just some of the time, right? But
he wouldn't write that Rashi was right.
No, occasionally, very rarely, he'll say he approves of Rashi's comment, but meaning it's an addition and sometimes an opposition. But he also accepts that Rashi often is correct.
Now, is Rashi like the consummate fixer? Is he basically, further his agenda, going to be the troubleshooter on any kind of phrase? Is that what this is?
So we're going to have to test this theory and see if it really holds up. Meaning, is this is this only on big occasions that he feels the need to do it? Is it all the time? Is it an aberrate meaning?
Twist it so that it works.
So that's a real question. We have to see if he's consistent and see when we find examples of this kind of approach and when we don't. Ellie?
My question is in a similar direction, that I think maybe Rashi had the same intention as Rashbam, but from a different point of view, a different perspective, different philosophy, and slightly different times. It could be that the Jews had less problems and were more open to listening rather than the time when you said,
okay,
saved.
Yeah, that's possible.
And thought they needed more explanation to stick to things, and the Rashbam is saying,
very interesting.
Let's
yeah,
take
I think
that back and, look at the text.
Yeah.
The text is telling you.
I think that's plausible. I think that that absolutely is plausible. Last question, Rashad.
My question is, how much contact did your average Jew have with a Christian in terms of really having this dialogue? I mean, how many people were really reading? I mean, I think the Christians went to the churches, and I think the Jews went to their synagogues, and there was a shtetl. Maybe I'm wrong here, but I don't know how much contact on a day-to-day basis, even if they had contact, do they have theological discussions? That about any kind of level where this would really be such an issue?
So that's a great question. My friend and colleague, Rabbi Straffler, is probably in a better position to answer that question. Rabbi Straffler, do you want to weigh in on that?
The answer is yes, there was contact. And there's also many great rabbis who were pushed by the discussions with Christian scholars to go over to the other side and say things that for certain Christians. Some great converts to Judaism which took place specifically during this period. And there's much going on as far as polemic is concerned, where Christianity is a threat to Judaism and Judaism is a threat to Christianity in this context. And there is an awful lot of debates we find through Jewish history, and many of them stick out. Of course, the debate of 1263 in Barcelona. But there are many debates throughout this period, and there is a lot going on interfaith-wise between Jews and Christians.
So I think you're right. I don't know if you could ever really know in a little town, how much interaction there is.
Yeah. Had that, but I'm just wondering on a day-to-day basis among the ordinary people, how much of this really went on.
So I think that's an open question. But Rabbi Straffler has really framed it nicely, which is that on the bigger level, there really is that dialogue, and it's going in both directions. Let's just wrap up, and I'll be here for any questions. I invite everyone to stay tuned for Rabbi Straffler's second part in his series, Moses, Muhammad, and Me. And we will continue with God's help at the same time next week. I wish everyone a good evening. Yes.